Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome. I'm delighted you're here. I am here in two dimensions. In a sense, I'm physically here, but my body is still back in Tokyo. I just flew in yesterday, and I'm getting too old for this. This is happening too fast these days. I had a wonderful visit to Tokyo and then to Kyoto. We had a big conference there and wanted to get a kind of first-hand impressions of what's happening in Japan, more than anything just to inform my thinking for today. First of all, let me just say, Hayashi-san, welcome. We're delighted to have, I think this is our fifth JETRO CSIS conference, and we greatly appreciate having these opportunities. Thank you for making it possible for us to do this with you. It's probably more important right now than in previous years. There's so much that's moving, both between our two countries, domestically within our two countries, and in the world stage at large. We have a new administration here, and we're trying to deal with the challenges of this very serious recession. In Japan is going through a fairly profound political change itself. Don't know where it's going to go, And matter of fact, I asked everybody, and everybody had the same answer. We don't know. We don't know where it's going. But you have a sense very, very large things are now happening. And that's why it's so important to be able to get together and have a conference with all of you, with experts, for us to think this through together. The one thing I do think is, in the midst of all of this uncertainty that is very clear, is how important the Japan-American partnership is. As you all know, Prime Minister Aso was here about 10 days ago, the first head of state to be welcomed to the White House by the Obama administration. They were perfectly aware of Aso-san's political vulnerabilities and weaknesses. They knew all about that. It was really, and they said, should we do it or not? And they said, absolutely we should, because this is about Japan and about the importance of this relationship with Japan. I thought that was a very important development. And said many times in our meetings in Japan that we've taken ourselves now to a much deeper partnership. And we're having a lot of turmoil here. You're having a lot of turmoil in Japan. And we're going to go right through it because of the depth of support and interest that we have with each other. So I'm very glad that we can explore some of that today. I'm going to turn to Michael Green to get us started for real, but wanted to say thank you to you all. We're going to depend on you today for the quality of this session, because your interaction with the speakers will be a foundation about how good this is. So, Hayashi-san, thank you again for you and your great team at JETRO. We look forward to hearing you. And Michael, let me turn to you to get us started for real. Thank you all for coming.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Michael Green from CSIS. The JETRO roundtable seminar with CSIS is, I believe, in its sixth or seventh year. It started before I came here. We benefit from it enormously. It's an important opportunity to get the Washington policy community thinking about our engagement economically with the Pacific Rim and with East Asia. I think it's especially timely now, of course, given the financial crisis, but also some of the dangers of all of our countries turning inward and forgetting about the benefits of an open trading system and an open and inclusive regional architecture in Asia. And we'll talk about all of those things today with our distinguished list of speakers. But to kick off the day, I'd like to introduce the chairman of JETRO, Chairman Hayashi. He is a distinguished veteran of the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, which he joined in 1966 after studying at Tokyo University in Oxford. He had all of the key jobs in METI, The Basic Industry Bureau directed the International Trade and Policy Bureau and the Small and Medium Enterprises Agency. Was a senior executive director at the OECF, taught at Saitama University in the economics department, was at Mitsui & Company, and became chairman of JETRO in 2007. Hayashi-san retired from the Ministry of International Trade and Industry in the last year that it was called the Ministry of International Trade and Industry. They changed the name to METI the year he left. That was a painful thing for me. I had just written a book on Japanese politics and had to go back to Columbia University Press and replace all the METIs with METIs. I've always wondered why it happened, and looking at Hayashi-san's bio, I know why now. Once he left METI, it could never again be METI. And they had to come up with some new name. But fortunately for us, he's now chairman of JETRO and is the guiding light for our conference. So Hayashi-san is going to kick off with opening remarks for the seminar. Please. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Green. And good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I am Yasuo Hayashi, chairman of JETRO. And thank you very much for joining us for today, JETRO CSIS meeting. And thank you for your complimentary remarks on my career. And I would also like to thank Dr. John Hamre, head of CSIS, and Dr. Michael Green, senior advisor and Japan chair, and their colleagues at CSIS for helping make today's event possible. And I noticed Ambassador Hasak is here. Thank you for coming. And today, I would like to share my views on 3 points. First, the roles of Japan and the U.S. in the global financial crisis. The second, economic integration in East Asia and the revitalization of APEC. Third, East Asia's challenges towards achieving further integration. The first, the roles of Japan and the U.S. in the current global economic crisis. The financial crisis triggered by the U.S. subprime mortgage meltdown is now affecting real economies across the globe. In January, the IMF revised its 2009 world economic growth projection downwards to 0.5%, the lowest figure since the end of World War II. Looking at Japan, the economy had been on an export-led recovery path since 2002, before slipping into recession as early as November 2007, and worsening under the weight of the worldwide slowdown and the yen's sharp rise against key currencies. Meanwhile, prospects for the Japanese economy in fiscal 2009 vary, even within the government. Japan's cabinet adopted a target growth rate of 0% in real terms in mid-January. Well, this 0% is really a zero growth. I mentioned this and they discouraged many members attending Davos, it aimed to achieve through stimulus packages, while the Bank of Japan projected -2% growth at its January monetary policy meeting. These figures may be further revised, likely downwards, considering the sharp drop in Japan's GDP in the last quarter of 2008, and poor prospects for the global economy. At this past January's World Economic Forum in Davos, I mentioned, which I attended, there was talk among world leaders that China, India, and other emerging economies could keep the global economy going by stimulating domestic demand, giving the US, Japanese, and the European economies precious time to go back on their feet. But I think it is up to these developed countries, the proponents of free market economy, to create scenarios for self-made recovery and growth. But this is imperative to restoring the damaged credibility for free market proponents. Before the downturn, global economic growth was being driven by strong consumption in the United States. But that this consumption has dried up, it's imperative for countries to develop new growth models that place less emphasis on U.S. demand and more on domestic or regional demand. This would also help correct global trade imbalances. It is very encouraging to see that many countries are already taking bold measures to bring their economies back to life, and I hope for their success. Amidst these efforts, however, some countries are letting protectionism seep into their trade policies. India, for example, imposed restrictions on imports of steel products, tires, and other automotive items, while Russia raised import duties on passenger cars, buses, and trucks, including used ones. There is also fear that excessive government support of domestic industries in the United States and parts of Europe may lead to a distortion of trade. A free and open system of trade and investment is essential for creating sustainable global demand. Protectionism leads to a contraction of global trade, which would only aggravate the state of the world economy and therefore must be avoided at all costs. This is a lesson that mankind learned out of a bitter experience in the early 20th century. You know, you see the enormous number of cars making a long queue in Russia. I asked my staff to find good pictures, but these are the examples. I believe that Japan and the U.S. can contribute to the world economy by making concerted efforts towards the creation of the new global system based on free trade in such forums as the WTO and APEC. I understand that getting America's economy back on track by reviving the financial system and solving the housing problem through an economic stimulus plan is the new administration's top priority. The fear, however, is an increasing protectionist trend, such as the Buy American provisions in the stimulus package, favoring U.S. steelmakers, and requiring the U.S. Transportation Security Administration to buy uniforms and textile products made with 100% U.S. content. The package also includes huge investments in green industries, a sector that ranks highly in the Obama administration's agenda. Here, the U.S. needs to keep a pathway open in free trade in order to have access to the world's best available environmental products and technologies. Protectionism would not only hurt the competitiveness of the U.S. economy, but may also trigger a cycle of retaliation that would prolong the global economic downturn. Japan, as you know, is a world leader in environmental-related fields, such as hybrid cars, solar power generation, and energy-efficient homes. So I think there is considerable room for U.S.-Japan cooperation in these sustainability areas. I will move to the second economic integration in East Asia and the revitalization of APEC. My next topic. To date, Japan has economic partnership agreement, or EPAs, in effect with Singapore, Mexico, Malaysia, Chile, Thailand, Indonesia, Brunei, Philippines, and ASEAN as a whole. And recently, signed EPAs with Vietnam and Switzerland. Japan is also in talks with South Korea, India, Australia, and Gulf Cooperation Council, GCC, and EPAs with the EU, US, and China may be considered as well. It may take some time. When you look at East Asia, a huge market covering Japan, China, South Korea, India, and also ASEAN, with a total population of 3 billion, it is clear that sustainable economic growth of this region, the world's growth center, is a key to the development of the global economy. In recent years, East Asia's contribution rate to world economic growth has been more than 40%. In other words, more than two-fifths of the global economic expansion was created by this region. In June 2008, the Economic Research Institute for ASEAN and East Asia, it's called ERIA, E-R-I-A, was established by the ASEAN Secretariat, the Asian Development Bank, and the key research bodies in the ASEAN plus six countries, including JETRO's Institute of Developing Economies, JETRO IDE. ERIA was set up as a regional body to make policy recommendations on facilitating East Asia's economic integration and conducts research projects on a wide range of topics aimed at narrowing the region's disparities, such as improvement of logistics networks, policies for small and medium-sized enterprises, and the environment and energy issues. In a region where some member countries are per capita GDP 100 times that of others, correcting disparities is a top priority for smooth integration. It's very difficult to have the common values with so much disparities in present. Another key body for promoting the region's integration is APEC, or the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. The Asia-Pacific region faces a host of issues, and APEC is tasked with leading in their resolution. And Japan and the U.S. will be hosting APEC's annual meetings next year and in 2011, during which time I hope to see APEC regain its strength. In recent years, APEC's activities have focused on trade and investment liberalization, particularly since 1993, when the first APEC economic leaders meeting was held under the leadership of the President Clinton. It was in this context that the U.S. proposed the free trade area of the Asia-Pacific FTAAP in 2006. 2010 is the target year for developed members of APEC to meet the Bogor goals of free and open trade and investment. Japan and the U.S. can work together to set a post-Bogor goal, APEC's new target and vision for the years to follow, as well as a mechanism for realizing such a goal. Well, the countries of APEC, and particularly Japan and the U.S. and Singapore, this year's host, are working on this new target. Importantly, we must do this in a tangible, result-oriented manner in order to display APEC's capability to solve problems in a time of crisis. APEC may also need to improve its decision-making procedures, currently based on consensus and voluntarism, which, viewed from outside of APEC, seem to bear little fruits. One possible approach would be to let members who agree on an agenda to go ahead and implement it, and wait for others to follow when they are ready. ERIA, the region's think tank, can play a role in ensuring APEC's success. I will touch on the third item issue, East Asia's challenges towards achieving further integration. To facilitate the smooth creation of this integration, however, four challenges need to be addressed. One, sustainable development of China and India. China and India are leading the world's economic growth now. The challenge is securing the healthy and sustainable economic development of two countries that have a combined population of 2.4 billion people. There are several critical risk factors that could limit their growth, such as regional disparities, poverty, environment and energy conservation issues, and inadequate protection of intellectual property rights. China especially is expected to play a constructive role as a responsible stakeholder in the international community by improving transparency and bringing its legal and administrative systems in line with multilateral rules and agreements. In this respect, Japan can utilize its past experience, technology, and know-how to help China and India in areas such as energy conservation, the environment, and infrastructure development. Already, Japan is working with these countries. In December 2007, Japan and China issued a joint communique to promote cooperation in the environment and energy fields. For our part, JETRO has been offering business consultations in our offices across China to help Chinese companies increase their business opportunities with Japanese companies in these fields, and supporting the Chinese government's efforts to establish a modern system of intellectual property protection. Just a week ago, I led a mission to China to help or to cooperate in the intellectual property rights. And I think they have already established a very good legal system on intellectual property rights. The problem is the implementation in local governments. And in India, where a lack of basic infrastructure has been a major issue, Japan is working to support the development of the Delhi-Mumbai Industrial Corridor, a massive infrastructure project linking the two cities that includes roads and improved railway system, ports, industrial parks, and other infrastructure. Japan is offering financial and know-how support and helping Japanese companies expand business in the project area. Actually, there are many, many Japanese companies already operating around the corridor. The second challenge concerns ASEAN. If the 10-member group is to remain in the driver's seat of the region's integration, it has to remain united and improve its competitiveness. The Japanese government is now working to follow up the de facto networks that Japanese firms built across ASEAN and East Asia with institutional level agreement. The likely path of integration for the region could begin with an EPA covering ASEAN plus 3, ASEAN plus Japan, China, and South Korea, or ASEAN plus 6, which includes India and Australia, New Zealand, and then on to an area-wide agreement. In December 2008, the ASEAN Charter, the organization's supreme legal framework, came into force. Under the charter, ASEAN now has a legal personality as an intergovernmental organization and is expected to develop into a more effective organization. But first, ASEAN needs to make every effort to realize a strong and cohesive community by 2015. The third challenge concerns securing the U.S. presence in the region. The U.S. has an important role to play in the development of the East Asian economy, and the region hopes for its continued commitment. The U.S. serves as a major export market for East Asian products and is thereby underpinning the development of the countries in the region. In addition, the U.S. is playing a key role in promoting the rules of advanced market economies in East Asia. In the process of creating FTAAP, it is important for East Asian countries to narrow economic disparities, both among themselves and within each country, and through this, come to share basic values. I believe promoting economic integration while solving these issues can be stepping stones to FTAAP. The fourth challenge challenge is furthering collaborative relationships in East Asia and the U.S. My hope is that the Obama administration continues the U.S. commitment to East Asia's economic integration. Japan and the U.S. can collaborate in dealing with various issues facing the East Asia economy, such as the financial crisis, energy and environmental problems, food security, poverty and promotion of free trade. Amid the opening globalization, countries across the globe are becoming increasingly interdependent. Therefore, solving various issues in East Asia and promoting sustainable growth in the region will not only help pull the world out of this recession, but also support sustainable growth of the global economy and open business opportunities for the world as a whole. For East Asia's sustainable growth, it is essential to further promote regional collaboration and to develop East Asia as a region that is open to the world. A prosperous and sustainable East Asian economy is in the interest of both the U.S. and Japan, and helps reinforce bilateral ties. In this regard, the Obama administration's active involvement in East Asia and cooperative relations between the two countries are essential. In closing, I would like to express my heartfelt gratitude to our many participants, especially those who traveled from Japan, China, and ASEAN, and other corners of the U.S. to be with us today. I am confident that this seminar will offer an opportunity for fruitful and meaningful dialogue on East Asian integration, U.S.-Japan ties, and other topics. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Hayashi-san has agreed to take questions for about 10 minutes. We have a microphone strategically placed. Junior, why don't you get sort of in the middle there, and you can come in a little into the crowd. You can sit down in between questions. I'd ask people to raise your hand, identify yourself and your organization. I want to ask the first question, if I may, Hayashi-san.
Yes.
What does the United States have to do to make the FTAAP and Trans-Pacific Trade Liberalization more credible? In your chart, you had an ASEAN emblem with three flags, and then an ASEAN emblem with six flags, and then FTAAP was just some letters.
Yes.
So what does the U.S. have to do to get its flag on your chart and be more credible on the FTAAP concept, or Trans-Pacific Trade Liberalization more generally?
Well, the first thing I would like to mention is that the United States' stance towards the FTAAP, although it was proposed by the United States, is not very clear. That means whether they would like to push forward or whether they would like to just see what is going on. I would wish very much that the United States' commitment to the integration first of the East Asian integration to be a, and then think this integration be a step towards FTAAP. So the fundamental recognition of the United States government to commit themselves to this sort of approach or the integration process is the major, you know, thing that we to push things forward. This is my concept, because Ambassador Hasak is there, the major responsible person on this issue is here. So I would like to ask her very strongly that please commit under the new administration that the United States express the commitment to the integration, whole integration process, because we are preparing for the APEC meeting in Singapore this year, next year in Japan, and the year after next in the United States, which I am expecting to complete and finalize the process, at least in the commitment basis.
Floor is open for questions. Junior, you take that half.
We just concluded our senior officials meeting one in Singapore, and we'll be headed to Singapore in July. And we have committed to continue the work program toward a free trade area of the Asia Pacific. It's an aspirational goal. I think, though, we have to be a little bit patient here and wait for the new trade team to get on the ground here in Washington. And then I think we'll be able to give you a little bit more firm answers to your questions, but we remain committed, at least in principle, to the aspirational goal of a FTAP. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a very encouraging remark. Well, while the discussion, a very heated discussion, is going on the possible agreement in Copenhagen on the climate change, and I can't get into the details of the contents of the agreement, but still, the very strong commitment to agree on the changing or the to establishing a new scheme for climate change is really important, and it may take. Well, I think the United States under the new administration may take some time to decide, but still, I think the Obama administration is committed to go forward to the new environmentally. A Green New Deal under the Green New Deal policy to commit to the agreement to conclude something very constructive. So I'm expecting very much. And my view is that because this issue is imminent and there are many ideas and the discussion items on the table, so I think those people who are concerned and who are discussing this will come out with a very fruitful conclusion. I can't get into the details, but one thing I would like to emphasize is that technology will play an extremely important role, and my view is that every country, including China and India and the developing countries, other developing countries, will commit to the reduction of carbon dioxide in some way or other, particularly using technologies. All the countries need to commit to produce something which is very energy efficient, whatever products they produce. This is, I think, an essential part of the story. So many Japanese companies are moving towards the countries, developing countries, just because of the restrictions in Japan is very rigorous. I think in the United States and the EU is the same. So I think the global scheme is essential. So global, I'm expecting in Copenhagen or in other parts of the environmental discussions, some global scheme can, fair and the equitable global scheme can be established throughout the discussion. This is my hope and my expectation.
Very much. I'm pleased to introduce our next speaker, my friend and colleague at various points, my senpai from SAIS, Bruce Stokes. I think Bruce is known to pretty much everyone here. He's an award-winning journalist at the National Journal and is... I think well-known in this town as one of the keenest observers of U.S. trade politics and policy. We thought it would be useful to start the day, in addition to hearing Hayashi-san's vision, to also get a reality check from Bruce. So please join me in welcoming Bruce Stokes.
Thanks, Mike. It's a real pleasure to be here, especially to see a lot of old friends, both Japanese and American, in the audience. And I look forward to your questions and comments, because I know I learn a lot more from those observations than probably you'll ever learn from me. It's an honor to be here, and I'd like to thank Mike in particular for inviting me. As Mike said, we're a colleague. We shared a mutual time at the Council on Foreign Relations. He went on to the White House, and I went back to writing things that end up wrapping fish, so you can kind of make a judgment on one's careers here. As Mike said, he asked me to talk a bit about trade and the Obama administration and, where possible, relate that to our Asia policy. Let me start with some reassurance, because I think there has been some distortion of the administration's stance on trade. I firmly believe this is a pro-trade, pro-globalization administration. Whatever concerns you may have had about Buy America or about Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner's use of the word currency manipulation in talking about China, I think that your concerns have been addressed, and I don't think you need to worry about those things. At the end of the day, the Buy America provisions were made consistent with U.S. international obligations, and the White House slapped down the Secretary on his comments and said that those didn't necessarily apply now that we were no longer in campaign mode. So I think that we should draw some solace from that. As an aside, I think also we have to be very careful about the way in which the concern about protectionism around the world has been used and abused. I think there is no doubt that given our history and given the dependence of the global economy, the American economy, the Japanese economy, the Asian economies on trade, that a slide into protectionism would be disastrous, and we should avoid that. By the same token, I do think that having traveled abroad during a good part of the time when this Buy America debate was going on, we have to be fully aware that the Buy America discussion became another way to bash the United States. It was the pot calling the kettle black. There was no acknowledgement of what other people were doing. It was only that we were doing it. We have broad shoulders. We can be criticized for what we do and should be criticized for what we do. But I do think that is dangerous, because it is, at some level, an overreaction to what happens in a normal downturn. And I would underscore this. In all recessions, there will be certain measures taken that are, by definition, protectionist. There will be a rise in anti-dumping petitions. There will be a rise in anti-subsidy cases. There will be other measures taken, and I think we have to be a bit tolerant of that. Observant of it, wary of it, but tolerant of it and understand it's part of the process. Because it does seem to me that those of us who care about trade, care about globalization, care about our relations with Asia, do not want to appear out of touch with reality. 66% of the American people supported Buy America. Politicians knew that. They were in a position of having to stand up in front of audiences, not like yours, but audiences in their hometowns, and say, I'm going to take your taxpayer money and create jobs in China. Now, no politician is going to be able to stand up and say that. There had to be some acknowledgement that we were addressing the needs of the domestic economy first. Now, we can say that was short-sighted. We can say that that was playing with fire. But I also think we need to be politically sensitive here, because the term protectionism can get woefully overused and more importantly, can damage those of us who worry about it, because we appear to be out of touch. And I think it's just an aside, and but I do think we need to be very careful here. Bear in mind that in the bad old days of the 1980s, 8% of U.S. imports were subject to some kind of controls. Steel had controls on it. Semiconductors had controls on it. Autos had controls on it. Less than 1% of American imports now have controls on them. So we could have an eightfold increase in protectionism in the United States and only be back to the 1980s, not to the 1930s. Again, no one wants to go back to the 1980s. I think that would be a disaster. But I also think we need to have some perspective here, or else we risk creating, I think, some of the backlash that we most fear. I do think, though, if you want to have some worries about this administration, I suggest that you not worry about protectionism. You worry about indifference. With more pressing, competing domestic concerns and priorities for this administration, I think the inclination is going to be to let sleeping dogs lie, that trade will be viewed as too difficult of an issue. Trade liberalization will be viewed as too difficult an issue to make a priority. And I think that is the major concern. And that rather than having an offensive trade policy out of this administration, you should expect a defensive one. And a defensive trade policy is protectionist by definition, if only because there's a lack of a countervailing liberalizing strategy. So if you want to call protectionism, fine. But I think you have to understand the context it'll be happening in. There's a political context, which I'm sure you're very aware of. Trade is not a terribly popular item among the American public. One of the things I do is the Pew Global Attitude Survey, and our survey showed last year that support for trade in the United States had fallen off 25 percentage points since 2002. That was the steepest drop of any country in the world by far. A new Gallup poll that came out in February of this year showed that 47% of the public thinks that trade is a threat to the economy, and only 44% see it as an opportunity. So there's a real division out there in the body politic. There's a similar divide in Congress. There's been a growing trade skeptical minority in the House of Representatives over the last two election cycles. It's not a majority, but it's a very strong, outspoken minority. And it will only complicate dealing with trade issues on Capitol Hill going forward for the administration. And I think it'll make them wary of addressing the issue. Now, I do think the key administration officials that we know about can be easily and safely classified as pro-trade, pro-globalization. Larry Summers, clearly, has his historical record suggests he's a strong supporter of globalization and trade. Diana Farrell, one of his key assistants, used to head up the McKinsey Global Institute, strong supporter of outsourcing, which doesn't make her very popular on the left. Mike Froman, who is the G20 Sherpa, is also a strong has been a strong supporter of globalization in the past. I don't think there's anything to worry about from those officials. Our new newly appointed, hopefully he'll get confirmed, Secretary of Commerce was a strong pro-trade governor of Washington State. The new USTR, again, hopefully he'll get confirmed, it does not have much of a track record on trade, but the track record that he has is pro-trade. So I think that from that perspective, we don't have much to worry about. I think that the president himself, despite what he may have said in some campaign appearances, is a person who formed his worldview and came of age in the era of globalization. He is instinctively, I think, a globalist in a way that someone like me, who formed maybe my worldview in the 1960s, cannot be, however much I might try. It's a different worldview, and I think that he is intuitively pro-globalization, and I think that the way they handled Buy America would demonstrate that. The problem, it seems to me, is that one's policy instincts are going to be at war with one's political instincts in the administration. My guess is that people like Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod, the president's political advisors, are likely to be arguing against making investing a whole lot of political capital in trade fights on Capitol Hill. I mean, it's not clear where the upside would be politically for this administration to do that. Bear in mind that Bill Clinton, who was one of our strongest supporters of trade coming into the administration, got the Uruguay round passed, got the NAFTA passed when people thought that was going to be difficult and wasn't sure he supported it. By the end of his administration, it was clear politically that there was just no upside to fighting these kinds of trade fights. And his and the weight of his advisors was to avoid those kinds of fights. So I think that there will be those kind of pressures on this administration. Now, it's true that they won't have the luxury of picking their fights. Buy America, I think, is a perfect example. I think it crept up on them. They didn't anticipate it. They didn't have a plan to deal with it. And there'll be more of those kinds of problems. Trade's inextricably entwined with foreign policy, as all of you well know. And the administration officials will look, when they're looking for cooperation with Pakistan or with China on various issues, what they're going to get back is, well, we need a trade concession here, or we need, you know, you show some forbearance on a trade dispute there. So whether the administration likes it or not, I think they're going to have to begin to develop a trade policy, or they will de facto have a trade policy. But it may, again, be in reaction to those demands. It's also clear that in dealing with a financial crisis, you have to address trade issues. The trade issues are an integral part of dealing with a financial crisis. Although it does seem to me that while we've had a lot of focus in these financial crisis talks about this pledge by the G20 to avoid protectionism, and then they turned around and all of them, 17 of the 20 countries, did protectionist things right after they made those promises, the real potential tension going forward in dealing with the financial crisis is not so much trade as it is a broader concept of burden sharing. You know, are countries doing their fair share to revive the global economy? The initial focus, I think, is going to be on how much you're spending. Japan, to its credit, is spending a great deal. The Chinese, to their credit, are spending a great deal. We're spending a great deal. The Europeans are the ones who, it seems to me, are not doing nearly as much as they should. But I think that's going to be a growing tension in dealing with the crisis. And clearly, some of the non-traditional ways of dealing with this crisis, non-trade-related ways of dealing with it, that have an impact on trade, I think will also become a problem. Hayashi-san mentioned one. I mean, we are going to practice industrial policy in this country, whether it be green technology or our support for the auto industry. We won't call it industrial policy because we don't believe in that, except when it applies to agriculture or the Defense Department or the National Institute of Health. But that said and done, we're going to have an industrial policy on autos and green technologies as a way to help get ourselves out of this crisis. That's going to have trade implications. We're going to have to deal with those, and it will be a topic of some discussion with our allies. With respect to specific trade, qua trade issues, the prospects, it seems to me, in the short run are not great. I mean, the Doha round is, of course, the big elephant in the room. It's been there for 7 years. The negotiations are stalled. Business interests have told the White House that what was on the table in July of last year in Geneva is no longer acceptable to American business, manufacturing, services, or agricultural interests. That's a very difficult problem for the White House to overcome, to try to relaunch or finish the Doha round. I do not anticipate much progress on that until next year at the earliest. We could be surprised, but I don't see how we get there from here. The free trade agreement, there are a number of free trade agreements left outstanding that need to be dealt with by Congress. The one that, of course, Asia is most concerned about, and Japan, I think, is certainly indirectly most concerned about, is the South Korea free trade agreement. That trade agreement has to be renegotiated. Now, no one will say that. The Koreans blanch when you raise the word negotiation, renegotiation. The administration does not say it has to be renegotiated, but effectively it has to be renegotiated. I do not anticipate that happening until next year at the earliest. Picture the dilemma the administration is in. We're about to give tens of billions of dollars to the U.S. auto industry, and oh, by the way, we'd like to open the market to more Hyundais. It's just, it's not a political argument you want to be making in the short run. That said and done, I do have some hope that eventually we can get this deal completed. My talks with the Koreans suggest that they understand there has to be more flexibility on their side. Folks at USTR believe, I think, that there are ways to work their ways out of this box. Whether that'll be sufficient to convince members of Congress remains to be seen. But given the geopolitical and diplomatic and security concerns with our relationship with South Korea, I do hope, and I actually believe, that eventually we'll get this agreement done. That, of course, raises interesting prospects for our relationship with Japan, because, as many of you know, it would be particularly galling to the folks in Tokyo if we did a free trade agreement with Seoul and were not able to do some kind of agreement with Japan. It would also disadvantage many Japanese companies. So I do think that completion of the South Korean deal, even if it takes a couple of years, does then begin to open up other prospects for what we might be able to do in the medium term with other nations in Asia. At least that's my hope, and I think that we should pursue it for that reason. The discussions with South Pacific nations about some kind of agreement with Brunei and Singapore and Australia, New Zealand, Chile, the Bush administration made a commitment to, but the Obama administration has not shown its hand on that yet. I would not expect them to early on show their hand. I think they need to do their nemawashi with Congress on this issue. I do think that it's an interesting prospect in the short run to pursue a trade discussion that's low profile, doesn't seem to offend too many domestic interests, allows the United States to stay in the game, and, interestingly enough, would allow the new administration to begin to evolve its trade relationship with Congress, which is not an insubstantial benefit. But to do it in a low-key way and to figure out new ways of dealing with each other going forward, especially in the absence of fast-track trade negotiating authority, which, bear in mind, the administration would not have for this negotiation, at least in the short run. I am sad to report I see no real interest in the administration's part in upgrading the economic dialogue with Japan. I happen to be a supporter of that. I think that we need to upgrade our economic dialogue. I would love to see us point towards some kind of economic partnership with Japan, call it a free trade agreement, call it a services agreement, which I know the Services Industry Association of the United States has now begun to show some support for. And certainly there's broad interest in the business and Japanese and American business community for some kind of new effort on the economic front between Tokyo and Washington. There is no evidence yet that this administration is much interested in that. The last administration, to be quite honest, was not that interested in that. I remember talking to Sue Schwab at one point and saying, well, what about a free trade agreement with Japan? And she laughed out loud, literally. So I do think it's a tough sell, but I do think, personally, I believe that it is so important that we should not give up the hope of this and try to pursue it in any way we can. Now, what I've been doing is avoiding the real problem, which is China, and what this means for our relationship with the rest of Asia. Later this spring, Treasury will issue its biannual report on currency manipulation. It's going to be very difficult, it seems to me, for them to avoid calling China a currency manipulator. Remember, President Obama did campaign calling them a currency manipulator. Now, of course, that has huge import diplomatically and press-wise and potentially on Wall Street, so they may shy away from it again. But we should bear in mind, technically, calling them a manipulator doesn't do anything. It mandates new discussions with the Chinese on the issue. There's no automatic sanctions imposed upon China or anything. From a practical point of view, it suggests we do more of what we're already doing. A psychological point of view, a representational point of view, a PR point of view, I think it's a more complicated exercise for the administration. And there are some ideas out there of how they might be able to have it both ways, say they're manipulating the currency, but it's not for trade effect, and somehow that takes the edge off of it. I think that's too cute myself. But anyway, there are ways that people are thinking of trying to handle that issue. I do not expect Congress to pass any kind of mandatory currency, China currency legislation this year or anytime soon. Bear in mind that the Schumer legislation was never brought to a vote in the Senate for good reason. They never wanted to because they were afraid the impact it might have on Wall Street. Well, Wall Street is in much worse shape today than it was back then, and it's inconceivable to me that you would get the Senate taking that kind of risk with Wall Street's reaction. But you probably will see some kind of China-related trade legislation, possibly to encourage the administration to bring more anti-subsidy cases, or possibly encourage the administration to accept what are called 421 cases, which are basically surge protection cases. There may be some pressure in that regard. There is a long-term Asia problem that we have, which will not be dealt with in the short run, but I think it can't be left out of our underlying concerns, and that are the structural imbalances that we allowed to grow up in the world economy over the last 20 years. I firmly believe they're at the root of the financial crisis. The long-term stability of the world economy, it seems to me, depends on the U.S. producing more of what it consumes and China consuming more of what it produces. Talking about that is not going to make it happen. We're actually going to have to pursue policies that encourage consumption and investment patterns in that direction, and it's likely to be a mix of policies. It'll be currency policies. It will be trade policies. God forbid it won't be a permanent recession. I mean, there are ways we could reduce the U.S. trade deficit, and that's being an L-shaped recession for the next 10 years. But I think that we cannot shy away from the fact that what we've been doing in the past, which is probably more free trade than we're likely to see in the future, produce these structural imbalances. And we are going to have to grope for a set of policies that reduce that U.S. trade deficit from 5 to 6% of GDP to something more tolerable like 2 or 3% of GDP, and by the same token reduce that Chinese trade surplus of 11% of GDP to something more tolerable. And if we don't, and we may not, it seems to me that we set ourselves up for the next global crisis. But it seems to me that is an underlying tension that's going to be throughout the first administration, at least they're thinking about the global economy. Finally, President Obama has promised to better enforce U.S. trade laws. Now, take this with a bit of a tongue-in-cheek. I have never covered a presidential candidate who said he wasn't going to enforce the U.S. law. And they all promised to enforce the law better than the guy before them. I mean, this is natural. That said and done, I think it is a recession. We're going to see an effort to more strongly enforce U.S. trade laws. People will see that as protectionist. People will characterize it as protectionism. I think one needs to look closely at what people do and decide whether, in your judgment, it is protectionist or it is merely a normal, natural reaction to the current crisis. Also, I think you should watch how we use the WTO dispute settlement mechanism. I would anticipate an increase in cases. The latter part of the Bush administration, we already saw an increase in cases. My guess is you'll see more of that. It probably is a preferred way to go in terms of self-initiation of efforts by the administration. Finally, an issue that Ashishan alluded to that I think we need to also think about in the context of trade policy, and that is what does the U.S. do about climate and climate legislation? It is the conventional wisdom in this town, especially on Capitol Hill, that we cannot pass climate legislation without some trade measures in it. In other words, border measures that deal with India and China, although India and China will never be named in the legislation, but it's people who are not part of the Kyoto system. If that is true, if we need that to pass the legislation, we should at least have a dialogue with our Asian friends, especially with Japan, with our European friends, to make sure that we pursue the same kind of border measures. Otherwise, the Chinese and the Indians will play us one off against the other, which would not be in our interest, would not be in the climate's interest, would not be in the economy's interest. We also, I think, risk in this town doing what the Europeans have already done, which is to buy off the complainers among our industry, to give the steel industry or the aluminum industry or the cement industry a free pass for the next 5 or 10 years, which is bad economics, it's bad climate policy, and it's great politics. And again, if we're going to do that, the very least we have to do the same thing, or else we create distortions in the global economy. In the medium to long term, as Ashish-san said, we need to think about cooperation on energy technologies, the development of energy technologies. The Japanese and the Americans, I think, are uniquely suited to cooperate on that, and we should do everything we can to support that. The details will matter. As he mentioned, if we support green technological development in the United States, the political pressure in the United States will be to build that technology in the United States. And while we certainly don't want to deny ourselves good Japanese technology, maintaining some kind of balance so that it doesn't look like we are subsidizing the green technology industry and it's increasing our trade deficit is going to be one of the political challenges going forward. I think a bigger challenge is going to be how we pay for technology transfer to the developing world. We and the Japanese have and the Europeans have the deep pockets. We have yet to figure out exactly how to pay for all of this. And potentially even more serious problem is what do we do about the protection of that intellectual property? And as he mentioned, the Chinese have great laws on their books. It's enforcement. And getting the Chinese to better enforce the protection of this technology will not be easy. It may be impossible. And we have to, I think, be very rigorous in trying to figure out what we can transfer. If it gets stolen, we don't care, or we care less. And what we cannot transfer because it is so much in our competitive disadvantage. I've talked way too long. In the end, it seems to me that we can expect very few new initiatives on the trade front from this administration, at least early on. But a clear vision of the Obama trade policy, I think, must wait. Wait until we get more people in place, but also, I think, wait until we get past some of the economic crisis and get a better sense of where they want to take the country and the world down the road. And that may be a 2010 or a 2011 exercise. So thank you very much. I look forward to your questions. Yeah. Anybody want to start? Yeah.
Bruce, excellent presentation.
Oh, identify yourself, yeah.
John Newford, Technology Industry Council.
Yeah.
Excellent presentation. And actually, I'm going to Tokyo and China next week, and I hope I can use your analysis with impunity when I'm out there. Really liked it. Just a couple of quick questions. I think we all agree a successful DDA outcome is absolutely the best. But as you point out, it's stalled. Do you see any prospects in the next year for harvesting some of the goodies out of the DDA, such as the Environmental Goods and Services Agreement, which was actually suggested in the annual report that came out from USTR as a possibility? The next question is, I completely agree, a more robust U.S.-Japan economic dialogue is the best way forward. Reality is probably not going to get it. But I can tell you in the high-tech sector, there is a tremendous amount of cooperation with Japan vis-a-vis third countries, like we're taking it to the Europeans' WTO dispute settlement over the Europeans' refusal to uphold its commitments under the Information Technology Agreement. And also, we're working very closely with Japan on some huge China issues that are standards-related. So I'm just wondering if your views on trying to recast that dialogue as being more focused on cooperation, particularly vis-a-vis third parties. Thanks, Bruce.
Well, to address your last point, I think this is one of the challenges, the broader trade challenges of the administration, is to get over the hubris that I think is inherent in most Americans, that at the end of the day, we'd rather deal with our problems ourselves, that dealing with the Japanese or dealing with the Europeans is just too much work and too many compromises and they'll hold us back. And look, there's some experiential evidence to that effect. But I think if one takes the broader view of history, it's unlikely that we can continue to successfully pursue our interests alone on some of these issues. We need cooperation with Japan and Europe. We need to re-engage on those issues. I do a lot of work in Europe. The Europeans are much more worried about China now than even the Americans are. And it's the Americans who are holding back the cooperation. So I do think that we need to challenge this administration to think long-term about that and see and to challenge them to live up to some of their multilateralist ideology. I, too, agree that I don't think we're likely to get much governmental commitment to an enhanced Japan dialogue that's really robust. I suppose, based on what you've said, one could conclude, well, maybe we don't need it. Maybe there is just a lot of business-to-business cooperation going on. I'm a little dubious of that being sufficient, but if it's the only way to go forward, maybe we have to think about ways to enhance that. It also may be true that people in the government, people on Capitol Hill, don't fully appreciate what support there is in the business community for a more enhanced Japan dialogue. Certainly on paper, it's very strong, stronger than I've ever seen it, in terms of interest groups basically signing up to this idea. The question is whether they really mean it, and I think that then the challenge, of course, is to those of you who are in those interest groups to go tell your member of Congress, this is a priority for me. But I agree with what you've said. Yeah.
If the administration's trade policy is going to be defensive in nature, as you kind of laid out, how do you expect it will affect the U.S. role and interest in shaping the development of Asian regions in the next 4 years?
Well, I think that's going to be a real challenge, a real problem, because you have to be forward-leaning, you have to be engaged, you have to be willing to go out on a certain amount of a limb. My guess is one of the first questions that will be asked of someone who proposes that is, well, what happened the last time? Both, did it work? No. And two, do we get any political bounce out of that, or do we only get trouble for it? And I think that's going to be one of the problems. And it may be 5 years from now, what's implicit in your question never happens. The Asians still can't get their act together. We've lost nothing. We've just showed that Asian countries can't work together, and this threat of kind of Asia will go it alone really never materializes. It's a pretty big risk to take, I think, in this global climate. I think the fact that it hasn't happened yet, as your question implies, doesn't mean it won't happen going forward. And we should be involved. I think one of the complications created by the global economic crisis is that if the G20 process and this kind of all of us working together at a global level doesn't work, there will certainly be stronger and stronger voices in Asia saying we have to take care of ourselves. Then the direction of that taking care of ourselves will be absent any American influence or broader concern for the global economy, understandably, because they'll be under their own political pressures, and that would be a real cost. So I actually think there's a powerful argument to be made. I don't know. I want to be the person who had to make it inside the White House. Yeah.
Thank you. Question for Ambassador Green. Ambassador Green,
you
have been speaking this year. My question about the United States stance about ATS buying of a U.S. Treasury bond, which is, as you know, that because of the Obama's massive stimulus package, it's important for how those funds are made. And I just wonder about the United States, your comment about the United States or administration stance, how the administration places importance for such funding from Asia, and that may affect the trade policy, like renminbi, as you mentioned, the Federal Treasury replaced the renminbi on the manipulation list or not.
Right.
Maybe be affected. You know, I don't think the United States should upset Chinese people who place on MEV or migration list under the circumstances that the United States need funding from Asia.
Yeah, well, first off, I mean, it's a very good question. I think your points are well taken. I think the pushback on this Treasury Department report will be this is a bad time to do this. We can't spook the Chinese investors or global investors in general. Don't underestimate the likelihood that that report will somehow be delayed. that is a time-honored tradition. But they can't avoid it forever, obviously. Secretary of State Clinton, was very vocal and open when she went to Asia, saying, "Continue to buy our Treasury notes, please." So I do think the policy of the administration is that we understand the value of this, and we don't want to disturb this balance in the short run. I'm wary of predicting that in the long run, the demand will fall off, because we could have predicted that for the last, people had been predicting that for the last 10 years, basically. But it seems to me inevitable once the global economy begins to come back, not just the U.S. economy, there'll be other investment opportunities, there'll be the memory of people getting burned in the U.S. Market, there's likely to be rising inflation in the U.S. market, and a depreciation of the dollar, which would make those investments less valuable. So in the long run, I think we have to adjust to the fact that whether we want it or not, the price of getting it would be too high. And that gets back to my point that we have to start producing more of what we consume, so we need to borrow less. Otherwise, I don't see how we get out of this vicious cycle we're in.
Thanks, Bruce. Chris Nelson, Eastern Port. Great talk. I tend to plagiarize as much as anything else here. Just listening, not reading it, I get the sense that for you, the financial economic crisis really trumps particularly what had been the major push towards the climate and the energy crisis, and dealing with it from an economic and trade way. So my question is, am I hearing you correctly? And what's your reaction to the argument that, given all the built-in psychological constraints about trade policy, can't climate technology and working with Japan be used as a door into a more forward-looking trade policy? Only you don't call it that. You call it, saving the world from dirty air and dirty water, and if we don't do it together, we're all going to die anyway. So who cares what happens to the economy?
That was a piece of John's question I didn't answer. I mean, I think there is some support in this USTR report, but also just out there, you hear it from people. Couldn't we do a down payment on the Doha round, or maybe even propose in the G20 meeting in April in London that we remove all tariffs on green technologies, basically? I think that would be a very positive step, because I think if the trade piece of the G20 communique is all about, nanny kind of shaking their fingers at everybody and saying, don't do protectionism, when we know people don't listen to that, it doesn't send a very positive trade message. So if you could find ways to send some positive trade messages in the G20 summit communique, I think that would be very useful. We should bear in mind that one of the reasons why this hasn't made a whole lot of progress to date is everybody has their own definition of what a green technology is. So the Indians said, well, look, you guys want white goods to be green technologies. You want refrigerators to be green technologies. And we certainly have an argument that if you can get a refrigerator that uses much less energy, that's great for the grid and everything. But from their point of view, it's industrial policy. You want to make sure that we can only buy your technologies, and that our domestically made white goods will never sell again. So I do think that we have to be cognizant of the fact that the devil is in the details on these issues, and this good idea has not progressed very far to date. Now, that said and done, if the heads of state of the 20 biggest countries said, we need to do this, you could overcome probably a lot of that opposition. So I support what you're suggesting. I think now your broader question about does the dealing with the financial crisis kind of trump all these other issues? I think so. I think we don't fully appreciate how bad this is going to get, and I don't think we fully appreciate how all-consuming it is for political leaderships all over the world. I mean, Mike can speak better to the White House than I can, certainly, there are people who can walk and chew gum at the same time, but the reality is there's only 24 hours in the day, and this is going to be one of those things where so much political capital is invested in dealing with this current crisis that you may find it difficult to get the White House to move, the bureaucracy to move, certainly Congress to move, and Congress can't do more than one thing at a time. I think that's going to be one of the other challenges we face.
Bruce, is there a scenario where some of the complacency, or you described it as disinterest, starts to change when the business community, the White House, notice things like an EU-Korea free trade agreement? I don't think the ASEAN trade agreements scare our business community that much, but the EU-Korea one certainly would. And in Japan, in Kidunran, there's a lot of talk of a Japan-EU free trade agreement. Could we, in a year or two, see a little bit of this complacency kind of shaken up?
Yeah, I've always thought that was a good argument to make. I mean, we must acknowledge that that is competitive liberalization, which didn't work so well when we applied it to completing the Doha round. But clearly, I mean, if you envision this Korea-EU deal, which is not done yet, but the Europeans tell me we're close and the Koreans tell me we're close, there are supposedly, for example, concessions the Koreans are going to make, or Europeans are trying to get them to make, on non-tariff trade barriers, which we weren't able to get. Well, you know, that may sweeten the deal for us a bit. Certainly, if you begin to see a spike in European auto sales in Korea, don't hold your breath, but if you did, that may make it more attractive to the U.S. auto industry than it currently is to do a deal with Korea. So I do think there's a potential there, and we should hope that the Europeans and the Koreans can get some kind of... And I do think there is a... The history of the Uruguay round, is that the business community got more and more interested in trade liberalization when the economy was bad. Because if your domestic economy is doing bad, maybe those foreign trade barriers that weren't such a problem in the past because you were really so preoccupied to satisfying your own domestic market, all of a sudden they become a little more relevant to you at the margin. So maybe you could see more business community interest in some of these deals going forward because of the recession.
That was fantastic. Everyone... steal it, but make sure you cite Bruce. One correction.
Yes.
The National Journal is way too expensive to use to wrap fish. but otherwise, your economic analysis and political analysis was superb. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
I think I'll stand here. I feel like TV talk shows. We're now going to hear a voice from Tokyo, Professor Shujiro Urata. Many of you know Urata-sensei. He's a professor at Waseda University. He has a PhD in economics from Stanford and his BA and MA from Keio. He's associated with Japan's top economic research institutes in addition to being a Waseda professor. He's a faculty fellow at Rieti, the Research Institute for Economy and Trade, at the Japan Center for Economic Research, Brookings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Has authored a number of important publications on competitiveness, FTAs, and economic integration in Asia. Urata-sensei.
Thank you very much, Dr. Green, for the very kind introduction. After hearing Hayashi-san and Bruce talks, I decided to kind of change my style of presentation because I was given half an hour to make my presentation in the program, but I'd like to cut it short, like maybe as long as maybe 15 minutes, I hope, so that we can have more discussions. And because of this change in my mind, in my attitude toward the this presentation. Although I prepared the text manuscript, which is quite unusual for me to do this, because I needed to speak what I wanted to speak in half an hour, so I did it. But if you're interested in this note, I can send you the file. But I tried to just use my PowerPoint presentation to make my points. And this is the contents of my paper and presentation. I begin by reviewing what is happening in East Asia concerning international trade, international economic landscape, particularly trade and investment. And then I like to discuss a regionalization issues such as FTAs, which include ASEAN Plus 3, ASEAN Plus 6, and FTAP. And incidentally, after hearing what Mr. Hayashi, many of my comments are quite similar to his observations, and I try to avoid some of the repetitions, and I try to make my comments. And then I end my presentation by giving some policy recommendations, my policy recommendations to mainly to the Japanese government. A little bit of them go to the U.S. government as well. Okay. So these are some of the points I wanted to make by looking at the figures and tables which follow. I begin by observing this rapid economic growth in East Asia is mainly due to rapid expansion of trade and investment. Of course, there are other factors such as the high savings and investment and abundant availability of cheap labor and so on. But I'd like to argue that the expansion of trade and investment played a very important role, especially for the rapid economic growth since the mid-1980s. As you can see from this figure, this is East Asia's trade, exports and imports, which increased quite sharply over the years. The bars show the values of exports and imports for East Asia, and the lines show the proportion of East Asia in world trade. As you can see, these proportions increased over time. And I just skipped one figure. I made a mistake in inserting the table before this figure. But what is interesting is the changing composition of trade by different countries. This is the East Asia's exports to the rest of the world. The share of Japan, which is shown by blue line, blue bars, is declining, whereas the share by China, which is shown by red color bars, increasing. And so this reflects the changing landscape of international trade in East Asia. And coming back to this table, this is another interesting observation which is happening in East Asia, that is the increasing dependence, inter-regional dependence. This is a so-called inter-regional trade share ratio, which is the ratio between inter-regional trade to extra-regional in total trade of the region. In other words, out of 100% of East Asia's trade of, to the rest of the world, 35.5% was done within East Asia in 1980, but that number increased to 52. So this shows how increasing inter-regional trade is taking place in East Asia. But when you look at the differences in the importance of inter-regional trade by different East Asian countries, you come up with very interesting observation. What we are looking at is the importance of China as an export destination to Japan, Korea, and ASEAN. And as you can see, the lines are increasing. So our East Asia's dependence on China is being increasing very rapidly, whereas East Asia's dependence on Japan is declining. And then this is the inter-regional dependence in East Asia's exports, which include not only Japan, Korea, and so on. But what is interesting is for China, East Asia has become less of an important region for their exports. Of course, what is happening is that proportion of Chinese exports going to outside the region, like the United States and Europe, is increasing. So China is an outlier in that sense. But when it comes to imports, this is the inter-regional dependency for East Asia's imports. China's dependence on the rest of Asia is, although not very rapidly, but it's growing. So China, again, is a somewhat different country in terms of its position vis-a-vis East Asia in terms of trade. Quickly to the composition of foreign trade by East Asian countries, the share of electronic machinery increased both in exports and imports. And here, I'd like to make this point. One of the reasons is, although this is not tested empirically, we know the ITA, Internet Trade Agreement in the electronics, which is to make tariffs on electronics products to zero, right? That must have contributed, I don't know how much, but to the increase in trade in electronics products. And if this is the case, I'd like to make a point that maybe we can, you know, if we can get an agreement on free trade on environmentally friendly kind of products that we are discussing, this will enhance the trade of these commodities which are environmentally friendly nature. Now, when it comes to trading products, what is interesting in East Asia is the rapid expansion of trade in parts and components. As you can see from the table that you are looking at, share of share of parts and components in total exports for East Asia vis-a-vis the rest of the world is 25.6%. Whereas the its imports is as high as 31.7%. So large portion of, especially inter-regional trade, took place in electronics and parts and components trade. And what is happening is the, although I'm just going over the statistics, what is happening behind these numbers is the formulation of so-called regional production network by multinational corporations. Under this regional production network, multinational corporations trade parts and components inside East Asia and then produce finished products in East Asia, like China, and export these products to not only to other East Asian countries, but North America and Europe and so on. So this is the so-called the triangular trade, where imports, where the parts and components go from like country like Japan, NIEs, to China, and then from China to the rest of the world. And this was working very well before the crisis happened. And what is happening, what we are seeing now is a reversal of this mechanism. Okay, and what we are looking at is the foreign direct investment inflows and outflows concerning East Asia. Again, we are seeing the increase in foreign direct investment in East Asia, both inward and outward. However, the proportion of East Asia in global FDI is not increasing, unlike the case for international trade. So in terms of foreign direct investment, Asia is not that important as opposed to the case in foreign trade. Okay. This graph shows the inward foreign direct investment by East Asian countries. The one on the top, the line on the top is for China. And what is interesting is the limited foreign direct investment inflows coming into Japan, which is the one of the lines, you know, underneath. Let me skip some of these, and then let me quickly go to the reasons why we saw a rapid expansion of trade and investment, which in turn led to economic growth in East Asia. And I argue that trade liberalization and FDI liberalization contributed a lot to this. I can show you some of the interesting figures. These are tariff rates, which are computed by tariff revenue by imports. So like it's like actual, quote-unquote, tariff rates for East Asian countries. And as you can see, a substantial decline in tariff rates for many East Asian countries. Having said this, there are still room for there is still room for further liberalization, trade liberalization, for many countries. It is very interesting to see how average tariff rate for China declined from 1992 to 2006, but still there's a room for further improvement. And I'd like to argue that in light of the difficulty at WTO negotiations, we can use FTAs as a second best policy to achieve this goal of achieving freer trade and investment environment. Sorry for small letters, but these indicate the difficulty that Japanese companies face in operating in East Asian countries. And many of the measures or difficulties are related to so-called FDI facilitation measures rather than FDI liberalization. By that, I mean a like lack of transparency in policies, regulations concerning investment is a very serious problem for Japanese companies to operate in many countries in East Asia, complicated and delayed procedures, and so on. So message I'd like to deliver here is the importance of facilitation. Of course, trade liberalization, FDI liberalization is important, but at the same time, as the trade liberalization is taking place, FDI liberalization is taking place, we have to deal with facilitation-related obstacles. Okay, quickly to regionalization issues. Here, the number of FTAs, customs unions, the so-called regional trade agreements, has been increasing rapidly, not only in East Asia, but in other parts of the world. Indeed, Asia was very slow in catching up with this trend of FTAs. It was until the 21st century that East Asia became very active in FTAs. And I have to make one, at least one correction. I didn't include Japan, Switzerland, which Hayashi-san told us it's been signed. I knew it was signed, but I forgot to put it in. but in addition, it is very difficult to catch up with the most up-to-date information on FTAs because countries are very active in forming FTAs. Okay. As for FTAs in East Asia, ASEAN has been a hub in the sense that we have ASEAN China, ASEAN Korea, ASEAN Japan has been enacted already, and ASEAN signed an agreement with Australia and New Zealand a few days ago. And if I understand correctly, ASEAN and India is getting close to maybe a conclusion. So in that sense, ASEAN has been a hub of FTA in East Asia region. And as for region-wide FTAs, three initiatives have been proposed, as we heard from Hayashi-san, ASEAN Plus 3, ASEAN Plus 6, and APEC. As for APEC, we have P4 and TPP. P4 has been realized, and discussions for TPP and maybe future FTAP has been discussed. And as for ASEAN Plus 3 and ASEAN Plus 6, ASEAN Plus 3 and ASEAN Plus 6, so-called second second track activities, like private sector. They call it private sector, but the it's a like a semi-private sector groups have been set up to study the feasibility of ASEAN Plus 3 and ASEAN Plus 6 FTAs, and I happen to be a member of both activities, and some people criticize me for being opportunistic or but the reason why I accepted this offer is because I like to see countries liberalize their trade policies regardless of the framework. I've been a member and I know the progress has been made on both fronts, and what they are going to do this year is to submit the reports. This is a second round report to economic ministers meeting and at somewhere, I don't know where it's going to be, but August. And hopefully that the economic ministers will accept our recommendations of furthering or moving forward toward the establishment of East Asia FTA, which is ASEAN Plus 3, or CPIA, ASEAN Plus 6, and they take these propositions to the leaders' meeting. So that was the hope that both groups have. And as for FTAP, there was a question to Mr. Hayashi about the U.S. commitment to FTAP. In my view, U.S. Can say set up like a study group. I mean, I know there's some kind of group, if I understand correctly, but this is only for government bureaucrats. But for ASEAN Plus 3 and ASEAN Plus 6 groups are participated by mainly academics and private sector people, and we get together. And as for ASEAN Plus 6, Japanese government is putting a lot of efforts, both financial and non-financial efforts or resources. So if U.S. is serious about FTAP, U.S. can take the cost, like, you know, can put in some resources to set up a group and then lead the discussions. And we haven't seen, as far as I'm concerned, we haven't seen any of such activities coming from the U.S. I'd like to emphasize the importance of comprehensiveness in these FTAs, or sometimes called EPA, which stands for Economic Partnership Agreement, which include not only trade liberalization, which is included in traditional FTA, but also facilitation and economic cooperation. And I think facilitation and economic cooperation are two keys. Trade liberalization, we know it is very important, but it is very difficult to move forward. And it's less difficult to move forward in facilitation and economic cooperation. And I think this is a way we can go forward, not only, you know, in these regional, like ASEAN Plus 3, ASEAN Plus 6, and APEC, and also WTO. So this is one message I wanted to get conveyed to you. I just skipped these motives behind FTAs, which is quite well known. I'd like you to take a look at them. And as time is running up, I'd like to go to concluding comments, which include some proposition to the Japanese government as to the way that they can move forward in terms of FTA negotiations. One of the most serious difficulty that Japanese government faces, as we know, is liberalization in agriculture. And what we are looking at is the so-called trade liberalization ratio of Japan's FTAs, which shows the proportion of products which are subject to free trade at the end of the 10-year grace period. As for Japan-Singapore FTA, Singapore committed to open up 100% to Japanese products, whereas Japan only committed to open up, 95%. And what we are looking at is the relatively low trade liberalization ratio for Japan's FTAs for Japan. And to me, this is not what we should expect from a country like Japan, which is a developed country. And what we have done is to sign FTA with developing countries. And I think developed countries should contribute to economic growth of developing countries. And we are not doing that at all. So this is, it's easy for me to say, because I'm in academics. I know the problems of liberalizing agriculture. But I'd like to see greater opening up by Japanese governments in agriculture. And I have some... measures which could be considered by Japanese government to adopt to deal with this issue. For example, we can, the Japanese government can come up with like gradual phasing liberalization programs. They don't have to liberalize agriculture trade regime overnight. They can take up to 10 years. They can provide technical assistance to those workers who are adversely affected. And at the same time, they can, of course, carry out structural reform. And what we need, of course, is a strong political leadership. But at the same time, I think people like myself in academics and media and business people, they really should get together and support this idea of trade liberalization and send message to political leaders. Unless political leaders get such message from us, it is almost impossible for any leader to take initiative. This is what I wanted to say. Maybe I missed some of the things I wanted to say, talk about the like U.S.-Japan FTA, which I made a positive kind of assessment about a year ago in Washington. I'm still working on how to make U.S.-Japan FTA be realized. And so I should end now because I spent the 20 minutes already. Thank you very much. Right. Sure. Yes, please.
Fran Kernodal, FKA, from Alexandria, Virginia. As you well know, states and localities in the United States have been very eager to attract foreign direct investment from Japan. And particularly during the late 80s and 90s, we saw a great deal of investment in manufacturing facilities and hiring of American workers. Could you comment on your on the prospect for a continuing foreign direct investment from Japanese manufacturers to the United States?
Right.
Thank you.
If we look at the statistics, Japanese FDI or outward FDI is coming back, although because of this current recession or economic turmoil, that discourages any investment from Japan or from other countries. But what we can hope is that companies will recover from this crisis, unless they have a sound financial kind of situation. It is very difficult for them to make any investment. So that is first thing that I'd like to hope for, to get the quick recovery. But once it is done, I guess the question is what kind of foreign direct investment can you expect in the U.S. from Japan? As for manufacturing, many Japanese auto companies set up plants in the U.S., partly in response to your kind of protectionist policies. But at the same time, in order to serve customers, it is in the interest of companies to produce products at, within the proximity of consumers. So that's a possibility. But in the future, I think foreign direct investment in services or like future industries or competitive industries in the U.S. are the ones who can attract investment, not just from Japan, but other countries. So I guess one recommendation, if I may, can give to the U.S. is to improve the competitiveness of future industries so that they can attract FDI from not only from Japan, but other countries. And in addition, this pitch by local governments, like so-called like governors, I mean, these are top sales, so to speak, do work very well. So if they have their offices in Japan, they should be very active in recruiting FDI from Japan. Thank you. Yes, please, Claude.
Means that you're way down the road in the first place, and a lot of decisions that were made for the United States is invited to the table, which may not be something that the U.S. administration or certainly the U.S. Congress is happy with. Secondly, it foregoes an opportunity maybe we have within APEC, Singapore, Japan,
right,
and the United States. Wouldn't it be better for Japan to, over the next year or two, turn its resources toward APEC-related movement forward, short of the FDAAP, which I agree is a dream for decades, but move in the direction of keeping things within APEC that keeps the United States, and also importantly Taiwan, within the orbit of movement. Everything I've said assumes that the Obama administration can get back together and overcome the interest groups in the Democratic Party. But that aside, isn't this increasingly I understand why Japan went for the ASEAN Plus 6 to counter China, but isn't this increasingly the kind of, if not a dead end, is this a path that really works against the United States' interest for a Trans-Pacific?
Well, I don't think, you know, APEC-wide FTA or FTAP and ASEAN Plus 6 are mutually exclusive. I think they can coexist. The difference being that, as I emphasized in my presentation, East Asia, maybe particularly Japan, are very interested in economic cooperation and facilitation. And I don't know how much U.S. is interested in economic cooperation, although they say they are, but we haven't seen much of the money coming from the U.S. in terms of helping or assisting, say, East Asia, developing countries. I may be wrong, but I guess the point I wanted to make is that these two frameworks can coexist, and eventually there'll be maybe one APEC-wide FTA, which includes economic cooperation as a very important component. Until that happens, East Asia will work on helping. There are some non-APEC ASEAN members, like Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar. They are not the members of APEC. So, you know, these are the countries which need badly economic assistance. And we can provide assistance to these countries, and they can raise their level of economic development, and that will make them easy to accept the trade liberalization. So what I'm saying is that these two frameworks have different emphasis, one East Asia on cooperation, and I can tell you that I've been involved in discussion with CPIA, and both CPIA and EAFTA have three components, like APEC. You know, these call APEC three pillars: trade and FDI liberalization, trade and FDI facilitation, and ecotech. These are three pillars, which is shared by all three frameworks. But as for CPIA, they put first priority on cooperation, followed by facilitation, which are closely related. And lastly, trade liberalization or FDA liberalization. Whereas East Asia FTA, participated in writing this report. We said we have to do these three things simultaneously, like a so-called, we use a single undertaking, which was not really acceptable by these least developed countries. So there are some differentiation in terms of contents between East Asia FTA and CPA and also APEC. And so that's why I think three frameworks can exist, and particularly APEC and CPA, ASEAN Plus 6. That's how I look at it. And again, I'd like to see U.S. to lead the P4 TPP and put Japan in a very difficult position to be at the possibility of being excluded. And I hope Japan will respond to this in a positive way. So, FTAP will put the priority on trade FDI liberalization and not much on economic cooperation, whereas regionalization in East Asia will put greater emphasis on economic cooperation. That's how I look at it. Yes. Right. Okay. Thank you very much. The impacts of FTA are positive or non-existent. I did several studies, at least three levels of studies. One is to do a so-called gravity model kind of regression. And what we find, not only myself, but all the other researchers, is the positive impacts of FTA. This is a very simple, relatively superficial assessment to throw in so-called FTA dummy, and then whether this dummy is a positive and significant. In many cases, yes. Like NAFTA dummy is positive and significant. So that's one evidence. But when we look at the utilization rate, like you said, as for Thailand, Malaysia, it's about 20% of their trade between other NAFTA countries. 20% of them use this FTA. And we did this for Rieti, which is under METI, and it turned out to be about 15% for at the best. Because like Japan-Singapore FTA, they don't need to use FTA because Singapore is a free country. So there are some evidences to support the points that the FTAs do create, so-called create trade. But the interesting finding is the following. Looking at the companies which use FTA, they tend to be large. That's one to expect. Small companies cannot use, they're not well equipped to use FTAs because they don't maybe gain much by using FTA. Because in order to use FTA, you have to get the certificate of origin. Once you get a certificate of origin, which costs something, the greater the amount of export you do, per unit cost of using getting a certificate of origin is lower. So, but for small companies, in order to use only one export one unit of product, they need to get the certificate of origin, which is very costly. So what from this Rieti study that we did, what we did recommend to the government is to let the FDA, which is more friendly to SMEs, and like transparency issues and so on. But again, coming back to the evidence, whether there's evidence of positive impacts of FDA, I think there is, although there's a room for further study. But as far as I know, many studies point to the fact that they did lead to expansion in trade among FDA members.
We're a little bit overdue for our break, so we'll break for 10 minutes and come back for the panel. But Urartu Sensei, that was a terrific presentation and very good discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much.